Hey, everyone. Thank you for joining us. I just want to start by taking a personal moment to thank all of the many people who have expressed condolences and well wishes and reached out on the loss of my dad. And I just want you to know how much it means to me and the rest of the family. And my dad was an incredible man who led a full and interesting life, and he contributed a lot to the state of Maryland. And we're going to miss him greatly. But thank you all for your concern and your condolences. With that, I'll turn over to my colleagues for any opening comments. Madam Treasurer.
Governor, as the senior person here, let me say that I, like many people, actually do remember very well the day that Congressman Hoyer.
He's the one who came after.
Hoyer is after
us.
Congressman Hogan spoke up. They were very difficult and frightening times. And he took a stand that did not endear him to everyone. It was a really tough, courageous, and statesmanlike position to take. And it led many of us to think that there, in fact, could be a brighter tomorrow. We were going through what President Ford called a great national nightmare. And Larry Hogan was one of those voices that spoke up clearly and came to what clearly was for him a very difficult decision and inspired all the rest of us. And I say that as someone who later opposed him in some things and, in fact, helped run some demonstrations against some of the things he did, but never without this feeling of great obligation and respect to a really strong statesman.
Thank you.
It's never easy to part with it.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Mr. Comptroller.
Yes, thank you, Governor, and thank you, Madam Treasurer. I would also like to give my condolences, Governor, to you and to your family. And your dad, as the Treasurer noted, is going to be remembered as a man of great courage who had a crucible in American history, rose to the occasion. He put the best interests of the country above those of his party and, frankly, even his own political career. And I will always recall the special relationship that you, Larry, had with your dad. And he obviously passed along his commitment to public service and gave you a role model, which is fabulous. And which you are living right now. It was a true privilege to know Congressman Hogan. I don't go as far back as the treasurer, but I did see him at several occasions in the last few years, and, well, we all give our condolences to the governor. And if I could just switch gears briefly and take a quick moment to express my gratitude to the men and women of my agency in the Comptroller's Office who have worked so hard over the course of this year's tax season. No news is good news coming from my agency because each and every day we're dealing with an unbelievably complicated technological process of processing 3.2 million returns, and we treat every taxpayer with respect, with responsiveness, and we get results for the taxpayers, but it's not easy given the fact that, 90% of these returns are filed by e-file these days. We've processed 2.6 million returns. We've paid out more than 1.7 million tax refunds, totaling $2 billion. We've averaged 2.1 business days upon receiving your refund requests and putting your money back in your bank account. We continue to be aggressive in combating tax fraud and identity theft. We have successfully intercepted and blocked 6,500 fraudulent tax returns. Why do we know they're fraudulent? Because they're sitting on my desk. And they're fraudulent. And we're blocked, $13 million from going out of the Treasury. Additionally, we suspended processing returns from 93 tax preparation services at 111 locations around the state after we detected a high level of suspicious and potentially fraudulent activities from their firms. And, Governor, let me just personally thank you once again for including the Taxpayer Protection Act in your administrative legislative package. That has lingered for years in the legislature, and, it just made all the difference when you put it in your administrative legislative package. And I'd like to thank the members of the General Assembly for passing this very important piece of legislation unanimously after all of the back and forth, because it gives my agency the statutory tools we need to more effectively protect Marylanders from these growingly sophisticated financial crimes by actually bringing some of the perpetrators to justice. Thank you, Governor.
Thank you, Mr. Comptroller. Let's go ahead and get started with the Secretary's agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. We have 20 items on the Secretary's agenda. We have one report of an emergency procurement. We are withdrawing item 15, and we are prepared for questions on the other items.
I'd like to highlight item 18.
Highlight item 18, too. I think you have both Robert Gorrell from the School Construction Program and Adam Davisky from the Governor's Office here to explain this item. Oh, I'm sorry. This is 18.
I'm just pleased that once again the Commission on State Debt was able to recommend holding the line on the state property tax rate, and we will remain committed to fiscal responsibility and prudent capital spending. The days of raiding cash from the Transportation Trust Fund or the Chesapeake Bay Trust Fund or program open space and backfilling them with debt in order to pay for other things that are unrelated are over. We'll continue our vigilance to keep Maryland's fiscal house in order. And I want to particularly thank the members of the commission, my colleagues right here, Treasurer Kopp and Comptroller Francho, as well as Secretary Brinkley, Secretary Ron, and Director Higgs for their great work on the commission. Thank you.
Governor, could I just point out Christian Lund, who I'm told is here, who is the state's debt manager and a very hardworking young man who pulled us all together.
Why don't you stand up so we can give you a big round of applause. Thank you.
We actually stole Christian from the Department of Budget Management. We are still very appreciative.
Nice.
No, it wasn't. I'd like to take this occasion, though, Governor, to point out that Maryland is even more unique this week than we were last week in having a AAA bond rating, a stable AAA bond rating from all the rating agencies. Standard & Poor's put a negative seal on Virginia last week.
Wow.
And in large part because, A, they didn't keep the same level of rainy day fund reserves that Maryland has, but B, also that they're looking at the impact on employment and revenue of the federal government and its actions. And they see Virginia as particularly impacted. This is just something to put us all on notice, too, that people realize that what is going on in Washington could very well impact the cost of constructing schools in Virginia and Maryland. And this is not simply an academic issue. And so far, no one has mentioned downgrading or putting Maryland on watch, but I think it's something for us to all be concerned about. Another reason to be glad that we kept our tax rates stable, that we do have the reserves that we do maintain and we haven't gone into them, and that we have a very tight, consistent, and thorough fiscal policy to which we all hew. served us well.
Thank you. I'll also throw in there that while we certainly are impacted by federal spending and federal jobs, and just as Virginia is, the difference is we've added 105,000 jobs and cut our unemployment rate down to 4.2%. We're growing jobs at one of the fastest rates in the country, most of them in the private sector. And I think that's maybe why they look at Virginia differently than they did us.
Yeah. And I noticed that also, what the Treasurer reported. And that's what Virginia gets for coming over here and trying to steal Marriott from us.
Yeah.
Now they're over here trying to poach every brewery in the state to come over to Virginia. So hopefully we'll correct that image. But they're pretty aggressive over there, and I think this should help us keep what we have, I hope.
Well, and the previous governor of Virginia said stealing companies from Maryland was like spearing fish in a barrel. But I think we've turned that around. We're actually bringing some of them back across the Potomac River, so we're happy with that. I also want to note item 19. This item proposes an amendment to the Board of Public Works school construction regulations, which will allow for broadband infrastructure funding under the federal E-rate program to be included in state school construction. And we need to make decisive steps to bridge the digital divide in our schools. And with these new regulations, we'll be able, I believe, to effectively and efficiently connect more Maryland public schools to high-speed broadband internet. And the item before us today is the result of a collaborative effort with the governor's office, the treasurer's office, the Maryland State Department of Education, and the public school construction program. And I'd like to call up our policy director, Adam Dubitsky, and Robert Garrell from the public school construction program to provide us with some more details. Thank you.
Good morning, Governor. My condolences to you and your family, Madam Treasurer, Comptroller. As you said, this is really the culmination of the work we began with the National Governors Association, a bipartisan group, to close that digital divide, to make sure that all our schools, regardless of where they are, have the bandwidth they need, not only for today, but also to future-proof them. So as new technologies come online, new ways of digital learning, new devices come available, even security systems, they have the bandwidth they need. And the federal government has a time-limited program to match state funds for the construction part of it, to make sure that schools can have these construction projects and also get the federal incentives to get it done. And as you said, it was a collaborative effort, and it really became a template for working together, both within the government, with DOIT, with MSDE, with the local education agencies, outside consultants, and it created a real template for solving a highly complex problem by bringing people together. So not only, I think, does it work with this, but we'll also have a template going forward on this.
Great. Thank you, Adam. Mr. Grubb, anything to add?
Mr. Governor, no, I don't have anything more to add. I think Adam said it all. It is a good opportunity. The iron's hot, and I think that it's striking at the right time.
Well, great. Thank you both for your efforts on the project.
You're with the – who's with the IAC?
I'm the executive – your new executive director of the Public School Construction Program, so I serve the IAC and, of course, the Board of Public Works.
So how many schools currently don't have broadband?
Out of the 1,460-some-odd schools, about 80 don't have fiber optic broadband. Of those, 60 have projects underway. That only leaves about 20 right now that don't have fiber at all. 10 of those are elementary schools in Montgomery County that they're looking at plans. Some of the other schools are because they have a either a geographic or some other impediment to putting the fiber in. They have to string the fiber over a mountain, under a highway, and those sort of things. So we're about 96% of our schools now have fiber. These funds will be available for not only new fiber for those schools, but also to upgrade as necessary.
Okay. And how many areas in the state of Maryland do not, outside of schools, do not have access to the internet?
In terms of access to the internet?
Yeah.
I do not have to check, but I know that the rural areas have less bandwidth in terms of not only commercial but residential. About 10 counties are using Network Maryland for their bandwidth within the school systems. Other areas, for example, in the western counties, Lower Eastern Shore. They're looking for private providers to come in and help string that. The challenge has been the same as it was with either sewer phones or other things, is if you have a small number of houses, it's an exorbitant charge or cost to have that line strung to a small number of houses. There has not been, and I think that has probably been the impediment for the providers in putting that last mile of fiber in.
Right. Maybe you could just send me something on that, because there are my neighbors go to West Virginia sometimes for vacation, and they report there are huge areas where there's no internet. So businesses are obviously affected, and I found that to be kind of shocking. I guess I should go to West Virginia more often, but what about Maryland? And to the extent small businesses are, the schools are a top priority, but how about what's going on in the rest of rural Maryland? And that kind of surprised me.
Well, as Mr. Tvitsky mentioned, Lower Eastern Shore and Western Maryland, we're working very hard on a collaborative basis with agencies across state government and with the private sector to try to extend high-speed broadband all the way down to those areas where it is difficult and not cost-effective. For example, I think we're working with the university system at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and our corrections department to try to find a way to justify and to get the fiber optics all the way down to the lower shore. And we're working on similar things in Western Maryland, so it's important.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But thank you all very much for your...
If you could also take back to the IAC, just my personal observations, they've definitely gotten my attention by this action to try to cut us out of the oversight of the school construction money. And if you could just take back to the members of that wonderful body, I have no idea where they meet. There's like some closet somewhere that they get together in and make decisions. I personally am going to redouble my efforts to give transparency and accountability to the hundreds of millions of dollars that are applied to our schools. Why would I do that? I would do that because we need to respect the taxpayers who are providing this money by having oversight. And just my personal observation, they have definitely piqued my interest, so to speak. And
well, there's no I didn't know we were going to talk about this topic.
I'm sorry to bring it up.
Now that you brought it up, there's no question in our mind that the action was unconstitutional with this sentence they snuck into the budget in the middle of the night, and it has no effect whatsoever. We're not going to pay any attention to it. Obviously, the IAC is a creature of the Board of Public Works. Its only power and authority is what we delegate to them. You're an agent of the IAC, and we're not going to allow an unelected body to make decisions on billions of dollars in construction projects. The fiscal officers of the state are going to continue to do so, regardless of what the legislature may think.
So Governor Hogan?
Might want to pass that on to your members.
Could I just say, I thought we weren't going to get into it either, and I'm not about to, but I hope you will extend our regards also to Senator Hoffman. I'm sorry to hear that she's so ill and has been in the hospital. And I
Treasurer, yes, I understand she's doing better and will be out soon.
That's great. That's good news.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Any questions on the balance of the Secretary's agenda? Is there a motion?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0. We'll now move on to DNR real property agenda.
Good morning, Governor. My condolences and those of the entire department on your loss, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer, for the record, I'm Mark Belton, Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources, and we had 6 items on our real property agenda for your approval this morning.
Great. Any questions on DNR?
Move approval.
Governor, I don't. Could I take? I don't want to embarrass Mark, but
sounds like you're going to anyway.
I serve on your Maryland Commission on
Climate Change
with the secretary, who is the head of the section on adaptation and resilience. And I just want to say, he and his people are doing a great job. Pulling together things, working with the local governments, working with the regions. I think the people of our state don't realize, in fact, how much is being done. And I hope that somehow there's a way to get that across, because Mark is really on point, on target.
Thank you very much for saying that. I thought you were going to embarrass him in a bad way.
No.
Embarrassing in a good way. So thank you. No questions. So there's motion, a second, 3-0 on DNR. We're going to move on to DVM.
Good morning, Governor. My condolences to you and your family.
Thank you. First of all, before you get started, I just want to recognize Deputy Secretary Mark Nicole, who's sitting in for Secretary Brinkley today. Both of you are to be commended, and your entire team did such a great job on this year's budget, holding the line on spending. Third year in a row, we actually had the legislature overwhelmingly approve the budget weeks early rather than fighting down to the last minute. With very little debate or discussion. And for the third year in a row, we have, instead of tax increases, we have tax cuts. So thank you very much. And please pass on to your department how much we appreciate all the efforts.
We will do that. Thank you very much for the compliment, Governor. Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer, for the record, Mark Nicole, Deputy Secretary of the Department of Budget Management. The department has submitted 15 items for today's agenda. I have representatives to answer any questions you may have. Items 2S, 7S, and 8S have been revised.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Nicole. We have several speakers signed up on item 2, the state's pharmacy benefit manager contract, which is on the agenda for approval today. I think we'll start with the agency presentation of the contract, and then we'll be happy to hear from those who have signed up to speak.
Thank you, Governor. I have some a few opening remarks, and then
please.
I'm going to
yeah.
turn it over to Ann Timmons, DVM's Director of Employee Benefits, to make a presentation, which is
okay.
Behind you. Item 2S is the Pharmacy Benefits Management Contract for the State of Maryland. It is part of the State Employee and Retiree Health and Welfare Benefits Program. We have been through an extensive procurement process. The PBM contract has been recommended for award to CVS Health. This contract would replace a contract that currently expires on December 31st, 2017, and will cover a three-year base period with two-year renewal options. The Department of Budget and Management has determined that CVS's proposal is the most advantageous to the state, and we ask for your approval today. DBM is confident that the procurement was conducted in a professional, fair, and responsible manner that fully complied with state procurement law. RFPs were solicited in March 2016, 5 proposals received, 4 of which were determined to be reasonably susceptible of being selected for award. The process included multiple cure and revision opportunities for offerors' proposals, oral presentations by offerors, and 2 best and final offers. After a comprehensive evaluation and robust consideration of both technical and financial factors, it was determined that CVS provided the best value to the state, earning them the number one overall ranking. Since the contract recommendation was announced in March, ESI has filed a protest, and OptumRx has filed 1 protest and 2 subsequent supplemental protests, all of which were or will be denied by DBM. In April, both companies filed appeals with the Maryland State Board of Contract Appeals. These appeals have not yet been heard. For several reasons, we are asking the board to proceed with approval of the contract award today, despite the pending appeals. First, there is a substantial state interest in moving forward without delay due to the significant savings offered by the contract with CVS. The new contract is expected to save the state $78 million in the first year and $1.1 billion over the 7-year term as compared to the current contract. These savings will not only benefit the state, but also its employees and retirees, including those on fixed incomes. 20% of the savings of this contract accrue to state employees and retirees. Employees could see savings in the range of $60 to $240 in the first year, and retirees could see savings in the range of $74 to $298 in the first year, depending on their coverage level. Additional savings will accrue in future years. Second, acting now will ensure that we have adequate time to meet open enrollment requirements for the 2018 plan year beginning on January 1st, 2018. Transition activities must start soon to avoid the risk of disrupting benefits for state employees and retirees. Finally, approval prevents a duplication and wasteful use of state resources. Failure to award the contract will require two integrations between the SPS benefits project and the state's current and future pharmacy benefit management. This delayed approval could cost the state an additional $4 to $6 million. Let me turn the discussion over to Ann Timmons, our Director of Employee Benefits, to make a presentation addressing a number of other important aspects of the contract.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mark. Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. My condolences, Mr. Governor. I'm sure this is a tough week for you, so I appreciate that you are here today. Thank you very much. As Mark indicated, I'm Ann Timmons. I'm the director of the Employee Benefits Division, so I have oversight of all the health contracts covering our employees and retirees. I've been in the field of employee benefits for almost 30 years, kind of giving away my age. Some of the gray hair is from being in employee benefits. The first 20 years were in the private sector. I started in consulting and then moved to the employer side at progressively larger employers. I say that as background because I am confident in the decision reached by the evaluation committee and the procurement officer in recommending CVS for this award. The procurement was sound, it was thorough, and it was carefully and thoughtfully conducted. It's my direct reports who will work closely with this vendor, and I will be involved throughout the implementation and the duration of this contract. As you'll see from the next few slides, we crafted an airtight contract that protects and improves the state's interests, as well as those of its employees, retirees, and taxpayers. Let's get started. So just some highlights of our RFP. We continued with the 100% pass-through pricing model. We continued with our pricing guarantees and 24 performance guarantees. New to this contract are annual market checks, and we also defined the brand and generic drugs. And that is done primarily to prevent PBMs from changing the classification of a drug to improve its rebates or its profits or to meet certain performance guarantees. So we tightened up this contract even more. This is just a snapshot of what you have in your agenda item that just shows the rankings of our bidders. Any questions on this slide? The CVS offer really is the most advantageous to the state. They offer the best value. Their offer includes a price protection cap that does not run afoul of our transparency requirements, which is key. Day one control of new drug launches, extensive customer service training. They actually include specific elder sensitivity training, which is very helpful for our retirees. Prescription drugs can be very confusing, and it's helpful that they have taken the step to train their customer service specifically to deal with the elder population. They also spend 9 weeks on just training their employees on Medicare Part D. There's minimal pharmacy disruption. We're talking about all the bidders on this contract were the top PBMs in the country. So there's minimal pharmacy network disruption, no formulary disruption. If we delay approval, there will be a significant impact to this that impairs implementation. This is an intricate and complex contract, and ideally 8 months to implement is preferred. Getting eligibility set up, making sure that we have the transfers of any prior authorizations and open refills, all of that needs to be coordinated so that on day one, everything runs smoothly for all of our employees and retirees. It also impairs our impending open enrollment. Open enrollment is the fall of each year, and we will need to get all of that information put together, ready to go mid to late summer, because we're distributing 110,000 open enrollment kits, and it takes a little effort to get those printed and distributed. So that's a significant challenge as well. But it also delays the savings to the employees and retirees. Those dollars that were quoted by Mark are real savings that will be money in their pocket, and it's not fair to delay that for our employees and retirees, especially the retirees who are on a fixed income. It also could add additional costs to the SPS benefits transition, because if we have to implement two separate PBMs at two different times, we're looking at extending that contract for a cost of between $4 and $6 million. And we really can't overstate the financial savings to the employees and retirees. It's significant. With escalating health care and prescription drug costs, employees and retirees feel that the most. We passed on a 9% rate increase on the prescription drug for 2017, and that's real money out of individuals' pockets, so it would be nice to give that back. But it's also, again, in keeping with what the Secretary and Deputy Secretary have been doing for 3 years, which is to control state spending, we're looking at saving over $1 billion over this seven-year contract.
Well, thank you very much. Can you stick around, because we'll probably have some questions.
Yes, that's what I figured.
Could I also ask you, please, to distribute those slides, which we couldn't see from here?
Oh.
I followed what you were saying, but it would be a little easier to ever see it. Yeah, I get it. I appreciate it, but it should have happened before.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
Yeah,
sorry about
thank
that.
You. Now we'll go to our speakers. First up is Ralph Tyler, representing Express Scripts.
Thank you. Good morning. And first, as others, I join in the condolences to you, sir. Mr. Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, my name is Ralph Tyler. I represent Express Scripts. With me from the company are Mr. Jeff Scott and Mr. Jeff Fisher. We appreciate the opportunity to address you on this important subject. Express Scripts is, as you know, the current incumbent on this contract. It believes it has provided great and important and highly useful and valuable service to the state. It is certainly disappointed in the outcome of the procurement and in the recommendation. What it seeks is the opportunity to raise what it believes are serious questions about the procurement. The comptroller spoke earlier about transparency. To date, there has been no transparency with respect to this matter. We filed a bid protest. We have filed a Public Information Act request. To date, we have received no documents. The only path to review the procurement to determine whether it was fairly and properly conducted as represented is through the Board of Contract Appeals. There is, as the earlier slide in the agenda item noted, a wide disparity in the price proposals, which on its face raises serious questions. These are all sophisticated bidders, and the rationale for that disparity certainly has not yet been examined. And here there is an opportunity to hear the appeal and to still meet the implementation date set by the state. The RFP indicates an implementation period of 90 days. The proceedings at the Board of Contract Appeals can go forward. We seek the opportunity to do that, and if this value is as good to the state as represented, it would be there at the end of the process. Thank you. And if Mr. Scott could address the board. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Governor, excuse me, Madam Treasurer and Mr. Comptroller, just to echo a little bit of what Mr. Tyler mentioned, we're confident that we can continue to provide benefits as we always have with the state of Maryland at a high level, deliver savings, and we do have concerns about the disparity in this evaluation, and are simply asking that this item be deferred and not be awarded today to allow for the protest process to run its course. As many of you probably know, several years ago when we were awarded the contract, there was a protest, and in that situation, the state made a decision to allow that process to go forth and not award until it was completed. And we're simply asking for the same request today. And certainly the transition time frame, as Ms. Timmons said, 8 months is ideal, would be great, but as we see all of the big PBMs, we transition large accounts like this in 90 days routinely. So it's not not something that would be difficult for any PBM to handle. So, again, we thank you and would respectfully request that you defer on this issue today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question. Are you still up here?
Yes.
Yeah. So I guess my question is, I'm not a big expert in this field, obviously, but it does strike me that there are relatively low margins involved.
Correct.
And so I'm intrigued by the presentation by the by DBM that apparently the winning bidder was $543 million less than the next closest bid. I take it that was yours.
Correct.
So that's almost a 20%.
25%.
Well,
you know math better than I, sir, I'm sure.
So are we, is it your contention in the protests that we're not comparing apples to apples?
We believe that's a concern of ours, is that because we don't have visibility into exactly how it was evaluated, we're concerned that something is amiss. And that's why we'd like to be able to see, go through the process to evaluate that, to see if there's substance. As Mr. Tyler said, if at the end of the protest it's evaluated that these numbers are real, then congratulations. The state of Maryland has a very, very good contract. But we, because we compete in this space, I've been in this business 25 years, public sector, working with large state clients, it's just highly, highly unusual that you would see a 25% difference between bidders on a piece of business as huge as the state of Maryland. So that's what raises our concern.
And what exactly is the concern about generic versus brand name drugs?
Well, as Ms. Timmons noted in her presentation, they laid out very clearly a brand generic definition that's unique, perhaps in the industry. And so one of our concerns is did everyone approach this bid using the same basis for calculating? Because brand, as Ms. Timmons says, however you determine a brand generic affects many things in your underwriting and the offer that you're able to present.
And give me an example how that impacts the average member or state employee.
Well, it could
confusion.
Yeah. Right. From a member standpoint, what it would potentially impact them is that that what a plan, what the state of Maryland says, we wanted this drug to be defined as a generic, but the PBM has it coded as a brand. And so, therefore, the member is going to pay a brand copay. And then it also affects, of course, on the plan reconciliation side, as far as the guarantees, it would trail through that reconciliation and impact those numbers as well. But the members would be, their copay could be impacted, and they could be paying more than what the plan had anticipated.
Okay. So for the members and their families and retirees, what about these performance guarantees? Are they binding on you, and when you, I mean, is that something we can rely on?
I can't speak to what our competitors put in there, but certainly performance guarantees are very standard in procurements like this, and certainly we are held to them. If the evaluation clearly was done in a way to ensure that those performance guarantees will be measured properly and reported, then yes, they are ironclad.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
I'd like to give the agency the opportunity to respond to the concerns of our friends.
Thank you very much. So, as far as the brand and generic definition goes, our definition is not unique. It's based on the FDA labeling. And the example that the representatives from Express Scripts gave is exactly why we would want that, because if that drug is supposed to be a generic, we want our employees paying the lower generic copay, not the higher brand name copay. And we also want to keep the PBMs from changing that classification for how they're paying that claim and then changing it to something completely different when our auditors are going in to audit those performance guarantees. So that's one reason why we did that. As far as the cost differential and whether or not these are numbers to be believed, this is the whole purpose of our competitive bid process. We are here to get the very best contract that we can get for the state. Being part of DBM, our imperative is to save money. That's what we do. And there's, as far as transparency in the procurement process, everybody was on the same level playing field. The financial model built in, using our actual claims, built in trend and enrollment to project out over the cost, so those are real, true numbers that we can hold on to for the duration of the contract. So I find that their arguments are largely without merit. Yes, sir.
Yeah, no, that's interesting, but, you know, we had this famous prison food concession contract where someone just as reputable as you stood up in front of us and said, I guarantee you that this outlier bid, which seems so bizarre in the monies that can save the state, is absolutely ironclad, performance guarantees, everything else, and it ended up being we had egg all over our face. This precedes the current governor, but it was pretty embarrassing because it proved to be just a fairy tale. We had to go back in, and I think the prisoners rioted on the thing because there was no food. So that's the only concern I have here, because this seems like an enormous savings for a business that has relatively low margins. And let me just ask
you. Well, PBMs can make a lot of money from the pharmaceutical manufacturer, so it's not.
Well, that's
not
kind of the question
of
I was.
Margin.
That's kind of the question I was addressing, which is, what do you have to say about the previous contract that we approved? I can't remember whether I voted for it or not. Generally, I voted against Express Scripts all the time, I think. But, are we getting overcharged by 20 to 25% by the incumbent?
Well, since the incumbent also significantly reduced their costs, yes, absolutely.
Well, what? Help me then understand my main concern with this is, obviously, we want to take care of our employees and retirees. I'm not part of the system, so I'm speaking for myself here. But how are we addressing this issue of a long-term contract Probably my wife telling me to shut up. So,
good woman.
Help me understand why we would go, for example, with a three-year contract with 2 2-year renewals. Why don't we just go with a 2-year contract and see how it goes and then revisit this?
Well, the industry average now is a 3-year base contract with anywhere from 1 to 4 renewal options, 1 to 4-year renewal options. So our previous contract was a flat 5 years. By going to the 3 years with the 2 2-year renewal options, we actually have greater flexibility. And because of the annual market checks, we get to go out into the marketplace and make sure that we're still getting the best pricing for this service. So we're able to do that every year, and if it's determined that we need to procure it, then we have that opportunity sooner rather than later to do that.
Well, if I could get the options removed or turned into something that has to be brought back before the board for a complete review where you're not just
rubber stamping this, I might feel a little differently. 3 years is, you know, it's not my preference, but I can kind of see that. My concern here is that these performance guarantees that are ironclad, how ironclad are they? What happens if they just come back and say, we can't do what we said we were going to do?
Then they're assessed liquidated damages that they have to pay us each year. That they are assessed liquidated damages that they would have to pay us for failing to meet those performance guarantees.
And that brings the cost of the state down to what they're advertising, those
right.
damages. Well, on the timing issue, I don't really see too much in that because, you know, we're told all the time you got to support the contract or bad things are going to happen. And I think Express Script is probably accurate. We could put this off. What's your response?
We've started this procurement. We actually started drafting that RFP in the end of 2015. We released it March 1st of 2016. So we have been thoughtfully working on this with a 2-year goal to get to January 1 of 18.
And the revisions, Mr. Assistant Secretary, that you mentioned, this is before us with revisions. What are those?
Right, they're the ones that are highlighted in the on your agenda items. They're in yellow. We provide a little bit more detail on some of the aspects of the RFP.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. Jamie Tomaszewski, Chief of Procurement for the Department of Budget and Management. The revised agenda item states the substantial state interest that Deputy Secretary Nicole mentioned in his remarks this morning, so we just wanted to put that into the record with the agenda item. So the revisions were all reflected in the comments to you this morning. As far as the renewal options, we do bring those back to the board, so they would not be exercised without bringing them to you for approval at that time. So the way the contract is set up, the 3-year base is approved by you today, hopefully, and then we would come back after the 3 years with the first renewal option for your approval at that time if we decide to move forward with those options for approval by the board.
Review.
Yes.
Okay.
And then the second as well. So we would bring those renewal options back to the board before they would.
And what is the status of the bid protest if we approve the contract in the face of a bid protest? What happens to that?
That the appeals can move forward because my understanding is that the protesters would like to see the actual prices, which are at this point confidential until the contract is awarded. So they could move forward with those appeals. And we feel confident that we would win in that case as well, just like we did with the state medical director contract. And so there would be no change if the Board of Contract Appeals says that we did something wrong, arbitrary and capricious, which I highly doubt. But we would come back at that time to decide whether we need to do a new procurement or go with the board's recommendation.
So you're stating for the record that you, under no circumstances, are coming back to this board saying, we just learned from the bid protest process that, in fact, there is some confusion here, and we're going to ask you to change the contract or we're going to ask you to add money in because, we're saving 20 to 25%, but really we're only saving 15%. Even with the liquidated damages, we're not going to see you for 3 years other than our happy state employees saying how great the system is.
Right. That is our goal.
Saying that for the record?
For the record, I can say that the state did not do anything arbitrary and capricious in conducting this procurement, and we feel that we will prevail at the Board of Contract Appeals. We are confident in the RFP specs, and that is why we made it the way it was to be clean, so everyone was on a level playing field. Everyone had the same specs. Everyone had the same data to bid, to propose their prices, and the prices we are very confident in. And we can have CVS also tell you that they're.
And how long have you been head of procurement?
year and a half now.
You worked for the agency before that?
10 years.
Okay. So what does this say about the previous contract and the previous bid?
Well,
that we're getting a better contract for lower prices. Are drugs a lot cheaper these days?
That's really a reflection of the market, not so much the RFP. You know, the market has changed. We've adapted our RFP to that, and we got the top PBMs to bid on this contract.
That's exactly my point. What if the market changes?
That's why we have
next
the market.
Year.
We have the market.
That's why we have an annual market check.
We added that in so that we would be able to check it every year, not just after the base term, but every year of the contract, so that we can make sure we are still continuing to get the best prices because the market has changed.
Could I just
jump
in?
Yeah, I kind of wish we'd had that in the previous contract, don't you?
Yeah, that's why we have it now.
This, I think this annual market check is a terrific tool, and I would urge you and General Services, we talked about this in the Procurement Task Force, to whenever possible insert in things like the intergovernmental contract where we just ride on someone else, and in the beginning it clearly is the cheapest, most efficient way.
Right, but
to try to build in these market checks. I think that's just terrific.
Right. Yes, as more players come into the market or change the market or consolidate. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay, we've got a number of speakers, and thank you. We might have you back up again. But up next is Phil Andrews representing OptumRx.
Good morning, board members. I appreciate the opportunity to address you this morning, and I want to join everyone, Governor, expressing my condolences. There's no other way to put it than that Caremark and its price is a complete outlier situation. It's not just Caremark versus Optum's price or Caremark versus Express Scripts' price. It's Caremark having a price that is completely outside the industry norms. And, again, it's this question of if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And the difficulty is here is that this board is not the place or the forum to litigate these kinds of issues. And the board, Optum urges, should not deviate from its policy, which is not to award the contract in the face of a protest or an appeal. And these are not insubstantial or whimsical protests. There's a real question about pricing realism here, and the cost savings that are being offered up are the board's being asked again to take things on face value. I was here 5 years ago when the last contract was awarded, and I think for the comptroller and the treasurer, you probably have a sense of deja vu. It's the same sort of rush. You have to do it right now. We're going to have enrollment issues. The problem is the process, and there is a process, and the reason the board
has been rushed since they started in the beginning of 2015.
I understand that, Governor, but my point is they control all the timing on the evaluation and everything else. Well, it's just now it's you have to do it right now because if things don't happen by August. I know protests are inconvenient. I understand that. But there is a process, and the board's regulation needs to mean something. And the substantial state interest here is not the things that are on the board that no one at this point can really see because that information is not available. The substantial state interest is making certain that the state and the board, if I may, gets this contract award right. And there is something in the pricing that is entirely unheard of, this type of price differential, and it bears further examination.
What exactly is that you just said?
I don't understand
other than I only pay 97 cents for my 50 tablets of Atenolol, which is a lot better than, well, I mean, I give a dollar to CVS and get a 90-day supply, and I feel sorry for them.
I wouldn't feel sorry for them, Mr. Comptroller. I think they're doing just fine. The question is, how is it?
Maybe you can make up for it by giving this contract.
How is it that the incumbent Express Scripts, OptumRx, which is a other national leader in the PBM industry, and the fourth offeror, all had prices that were close, and this is 25% difference. There's something else going on there. It may be in the option years, and whether the option years ever get exercised is unclear. But my point is, the reason the regulation exists, and it's the board's regulation, is to allow the process to go forward so all that can be examined and the board can get the right result. And we've been focused a lot on price. I'd like to speak just briefly about technical, because the ultimate standard for award of this contract is what is the most advantageous proposal. And it's not just about price. Optum was ranked first technically. At our debriefing, Optum was told that Optum's technical proposal had no weaknesses. No weaknesses. So the question now becomes, well, where are we on the pricing? 25% differential, that sounds suspicious. But actually, if you look at the base contract period, the difference in pricing is only about 9% between, I can only speak for Optum, between Optum and Caremark. So when you get that close in the pricing, then the question comes up, well, what about technical superiority? And the other thing you have to consider, I think, is with this lower in pricing, does that mean there's going to be a reduction in service benefits? And if you look at how Caremark has priced the option years, there's a huge drop-off, I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars over the year-by-year pricing for the base contract. The comptroller's questions, treasurer's questions, these are questions that ought to be answered by the Board of Contract Appeals, and that process should be allowed to go forward here. And the point is, if there's a 9% price difference for the base year, then if it's a dollar, if you will, Mr. Comptroller, for a pill from Caremark, and a $1.09 for a pill from Optum, which has the superior technical ranking with no weaknesses, why would you take the chance? The place to examine this, respectfully, is in the Board of Contract Appeals. But urge the board to comply with its standard policy. The other thing I will say, and this was in our protest, Caremark has a checkered history with pricing issues and pricing litigation over the past few years. It's all set forth in our protest. I won't repeat it here now. But there are lots of warning flags here, and I urge the board to heed them. Let the process go forward as intended. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any response from the department?
First of all, that 9% differential is $100 million. That's not small dollars. Second of all, Optum itself is the beneficiary of a similarly awarded contract where they were 25% lower than the price than the next lowest bidder. So it's interesting for them to be making this argument to me. Also, they will get their day in court through the Board of Contract Appeals, even if this is approved today. And I would also like to bring up our consultant, George Bognar, who is an expert in the PBM industry, to talk about the pricing that's going on now in the marketplace.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. My name is George Bognar. I work with Siegel Consulting. I've been in the PBM field for 20 years, 10 working at an actual PBM, and the last 10 in consulting. I wanted to just spend a few minutes talking about, there's been a lot of questions around, can the financials be real, or the differences between the financials be real. So I just wanted to tell you a little bit about how they were actually determined. The way they're determined is we simply take the guaranteed financial terms from each of the bidders. So those are discounts, fees, and rebates. And these are guaranteed terms from each of the bidders, and we apply them to the state's actual claims experience. We do it the exact same way for each of the bidders, and the process actually allows each bidder to see, you know, once those calculations are made, they actually see what the bottom line looks like. There's nothing subjective about them, and I'd also comment there are numerous financial components. There's a lot of financial components that they have to submit. And in none of those did we find a particular price point or rebate or fee that is completely out of line with the industry. So really the result of this large difference over 7 years has to do with the fact that CVS provided the most aggressive bid in each one of those components, and when you basically extrapolate them over that seven-year period, it comes to that large $543 million. And as the gentleman representing Optum said, for 3 years, it's a 9% difference, which in his example didn't sound like a lot. But as Ann said, that's $100 million. That's a large number, I think, even for the state.
Yeah. If I could just ask, so it's yes, sir, a different figure than it's being presented to us, right?
I'm sorry.
We have a figure of $543 million over 7 years. What is the savings over 3 years?
A little bit over $100 million.
Total? $33 million a year?
Correct.
Well, that's a lot different than what we're being asked to vote on. I would love to ask my colleagues, let's vote on what's before us, a three-year contract with a $33 million a year savings, not a seven-year contract with a $78 million annual savings. I mean, I would just throw out there, I perhaps, despite my reluctance to award bids in the face of protest, would be happy to join in and vote for a three-year contract, but I'd like to see the right figures put in front of us. But
we do have all the figures here.
Yeah, but am I wrong here that we're being asked to vote on a three-year base contract that saves the state $100 million because over 7 years, with two options that have not been approved and will come back for further action by the board, there's a $543 million savings? How can the four option years be five times what the first 3 years are?
Well, if you want to talk about how the formula is the same for the first year.
Well, I think I can answer the question partially. So the difference between the bidders in terms of guaranteed financial terms increases throughout the seven-year period. For example, in the first year, all bidders are required to keep the formulary that's in place today. So that's a disadvantage to any of the bidders other than the incumbent. So over each year, the difference between the highest bid and the next bid gets larger and larger. And you're right, there'll be an opportunity to revisit the price each year through the annual market check. But these are guaranteed terms over the seven-year period.
Yeah, but four of the years are not guaranteed.
They are, sir.
They are.
By whom?
By the offer.
You're guaranteed in this offer.
Yeah, but we're not guaranteeing them because we're not necessarily approving them, right?
Well if you reject them, then of course. But
I don't know. I would like to, given the confusion and the protests, vote for the 3 years. I think that's a reasonable step forward for the state. And the four option years, you can come back down the road. But I'd also like to see the right figures that we're voting on. We're voting on a guaranteed three-year deal with this company, and they're going to, based on liquidated damages, give us somewhere in the $33 million range savings for our members. Okay, I can see that. The rest of it's just maybe gee whiz and gosh a rooting. And by the way, neither the governor nor I, the treasurer may be here 7 years from now, but neither he nor I probably going to be here. So who's even going to remember it?
Well, respectfully, Mr. Comptroller, all of the prices are guaranteed for all 7 years because those were the prices that were proposed by the offerers. All offerers had to propose all 7 years. So they had to guarantee those prices.
And why do they go up so much in the four option years as opposed to the three contract years?
Well, that's based on what the offerors proposed and the aggressive changes that they proposed.
I mean, really? Come on.
We can have CBS come up and...
Yeah, please. Have CBS come up.
We're only halfway through our speakers for this item, so save some of your fire for the next couple of people.
But we did guarantee all the prices.
At this point, we're going to call on Sue Esty, representing AFSCME.
Thank you very much, Governor, and good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. It's so tempting to say go for it. Their state employees really do need anything they can get in the way of savings. No one knows better than us the plight of our retirees and our members as far as finances go. But I do have to say that I share some of the concerns voiced by the comptroller, because sometimes it does look too good to be true. And given that this is before the Board of Contract Appeals, given that they have the opportunity to really dig deeper or drill deeper, I think is the terminology people use lately, into what's going on with this difference in price, we would recommend at least allowing the Board of Contract Appeals to look at these differences. Some of the concerns we have is, I think I heard maybe correctly, maybe not, that the formulary could change over time. And in past years, that has been an issue where members were dealing with a formulary that changed and suddenly prescriptions that they were used to costing a certain amount changed. And that is the kind of thing that we would like to see very closely examined. And we think it could be in a hearing before the Board of Contract Appeals. So I don't really want to take a lot of time except to voice our concern that we want those savings to be real and true. We want the process, and I have a lot of respect and have known for a long time the folks from DBM, you know, that have worked on this. But I think that with such a large contract, with such a potential for a large impact, it would be perhaps best to go through the entire process and allow that appeal process to go through. Thank you.
Thank you. And now finally, we have Bob Enten on behalf of the winning bidder, Caremark CVS.
Thank you very much, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. Robert Enten with the Gordon Feinblatt firm, and on behalf of my firm, Governor, I'd like to express our condolences, mine and our firm's condolences to you and your family. I'm an attorney in Maryland. I've come before the General Assembly and this board for over 30 years. I've represented CVS and its predecessors for 22 years. CVS is a $177.5 billion company. They are number 7 on the Fortune 50 list. They have the state contract in 15 states, many of them in our region, and they help to manage the contract and advise the states, 5 other states. I'll put it very simply. CVS made its bid because they want to have the Maryland contract. You have a competitive bidding process, and they made their bid at the level they made it as part of a competitive process because they wanted the contract. CVS in the state of Maryland has 223 stores. We employ over 5,000 people. We fill 21 million prescriptions a year. We pay taxes of $55 million a year. We had this contract, and we lost this contract to Catalyst, which is now part of Optum. Optum lost the contract to Express Scripts. We want the contract back. We stood by this state last year, and when things happened in Baltimore, we reopened our store at the intersection of Pennsylvania and North because we have a commitment to the state of Maryland. The idea that CVS would not honor its commitment and its performance guarantees to the state of Maryland is totally specious. There's no history of that. We stand by this contract. We're subject to the performance guarantees, and we're also subject to the price check, to the market check, which guarantees on an annual basis that no matter what the numbers are, what you pay us will be in tune with what's going on in the marketplace. The savings are the savings. They're guaranteed, and we stand behind them. The standard and the argument that we should just put this on hold and let the things play out at the Board of Contract Appeals because they'll delve into it deeper. I think as the members of this board know very, very well that what the Board of Contract Appeals does by law is not substitute its judgment for the judgment of the agency or this board. The standard for review at the Board of Contract Appeals is that they will only overturn the award if it's found to have been arbitrary, capricious, and an abuse of discretion. These are big contracts. This contract is big, but it's not that much bigger than the last contract, frankly, or the contract before it. They were appealed. And in both of those cases, the appeals were denied. That's the history on this issue. There is a huge cost to CVS to go ahead and get this contract ready for implementation on the 1st of January in 2018. And they stand to lose if for some reason the contract is nullified. But they'll take that risk. They'll take that risk because they believe that their bid was a fair bid, that was an open process, and they have no doubt whatsoever that under Maryland law, the award that was made here will be sustained. You have the discretion to decide whether this contract goes forward now or not. I think there's two issues. One is, do you approve it? And two, does it go forward? We would urge you certainly to approve the contract, and we would certainly urge you to go forward with the contract. There was no mystery about the definitions or anything else. We knew what we were doing. We know what we're doing in the other states. We know what we're doing in the marketplace. There was no mystery. CVS nationally manages the pharmacy benefit for over 75 million people. We're not novices at this. We know what we're doing. We'll stand behind our bid. We'll stand behind our services. It's in the best interest of the state to realize these savings now. It's in the best interest of state government, the best interest of the budget, and almost equally importantly, it's in the best interest of the taxpayers and the enrollees in these plans. So we would urge you to approve it. We would urge you to go forward. Steve Koons is here. Steve is in charge of national sales for CVS. He worked on this RFP. He knows it forwards and backwards, and he can address any of the technical questions that you have. But I think that it's all based on speculation as to what will happen. We'll stand behind what we promised. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah, no, I have a lot of respect for Mr. Anton. I've known him for years, and I also have a lot of respect for Mr. Tyler and Mr. Andrews, and everybody's well represented here. But forgive me. We're talking about a three-year base contract where there's roughly $33 million in savings annually, and then four additional years where there is $110 or $115 million annual savings. How do you explain that discrepancy?
I'll let Mr. Koons talk. He's the one that made the bid, and I'll let him answer your question.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Mr. Comptroller, Governor, and Madam Treasurer. In response to that specific question, the way that the RFP was laid out, it gave you the option to price out all 7 years. And the spreadsheet that was provided showed you exactly how many prescriptions at each retail, mail order, brand versus generic were assumed in each one of those periods. And then it totaled everything up. So it gave you the full 7 year total for the PBM contract. What we did based on the way that the market has evolved over the last number of years, I think this speaks to your point of what's wrong with the old contracts. This market has gotten extremely competitive to the benefit of payers like the state of Maryland. And so what we did was we improved our pricing each of those 7 years, regardless of what term you had, and thinking that you were analyzing the full 7 years, we gave pricing improvements in each of the components in those years because we bet on ourselves to make more efficient purchasing decisions. To Bob's point, we're the largest PBM as of the first quarter of this year. We're the second largest retail provider in the CVS stores, and so our purchasing power allows us the ability to procure drugs from pharmaceutical manufacturers differently. So we put numbers out there that we fully expect to live up to, and they're guaranteed dollar for dollar for all 7 years. But what we did was we bet on ourselves having the ability to continue negotiating more effectively with pharmaceutical manufacturers in terms of rebates, in terms of discounts, and of those rebates, we pass those through to you, whatever we earn back.
Yeah, I can see that. I can kind of follow that. But it strikes me as you've got two different bids here. You've got a bid for 3 years, and then you got a bid for the maybe 4 years. And once you're obviously the incumbent vendor, it's different than if you're not the incumbent vendor. And I, you know, arch an eyebrow at that. I like CVS. They're my pharmacy. I said that. But I don't like the idea of a $2 billion contract where most of the savings to the state come in years 4, 5, 6, and 7, maybe.
Mr. Comptroller, if I might, there's no maybe. There's no maybe. They're guaranteed.
No. In the face of, if we turn down the options and say we're going in a different direction because we didn't like the technical aspect or something, then your argument, Mr. Ennin, is turned on its head because you're a very big, powerful, well-funded, litigious company. It's a litigious area. But, you know, what are we getting into here and what are we basing it on? That's all I'm asking. Maybe you bid like this in other states?
Yes, and in fact,
we've actually been very fortunate to pick up as new state clients over the last 4 years, 10 state governments around the country. And so New York came on board, very large company, state of Florida, Commonwealth of Kentucky, state of West Virginia. We've had Pennsylvania as a client for a while. And in all those situations, it's been a very competitive market. We've lost some RFPs, too. We've lost some PBM clients to our competitors, and sometimes you get access to the information. But what we based our pricing on was our ability to be aggressive with the pricing at the same time as not providing substandard services to the state as well as your employees and retirees. And so it's something that we feel very confident, and we've provided a number of those as references during this RFP process because of the great relationships we have with those states.
And the other three bidders who are just like you guys, not identical, but significant players, they don't realize that the first 3 years can be one price and the next 4 years, three times the savings? They don't. How do they possibly compete against you in other states if this is your model? And it's accurate,
right?
I guess.
It's something that each RFP is different, and so certain states will only ask for a three-year contract because they're going to bid that contract every 3 years, and there's no option years involved. In this situation, the requirement for the RFP was for 3 years with the four-year, and there were pricing points that you could fill out for each one of those 7 years. And so each bidder had the option to choose, how do you price each one of those 7 years? And not being privy to what our competitors provided in theirs, what I can speak to is that in ours, we assume that each year the ability to purchase drugs will get better and better for us, that we would pass on to you, the client.
Thank you, Governor, for biting your tongue and letting me ask these questions, but it's a valid concern.
If I could just say one thing, Mr. Comptroller, and that is please keep in mind that this contract, even if you look at it for the 3 years, is so much more advantageous to the state than prior contracts, even over the three-year period. The savings in the first three-year contract of this contract will double what was saved in the prior contract.
You got me there. I'm comfortable with that.
Yeah.
It's the stuff out there in the future, particularly given your size and clout as a company. I mean, where this is not a...
We think that's an advantage to the state.
I understand, but it also provides a lot of leverage for whoever sits in these seats to have to put up with 4 years from now.
And in other states, Mr. Comptroller, there are discrepancies sometimes of $1 billion in the larger states between the bids. And that happened very recently, where one of the companies here today outbid us by $1 billion.
Okay.
It happens. It's a competitive process. You don't know. Had we known that we were going to be this far below the others, we would have had a much higher price. We didn't know.
Appreciate that honesty. Any further questions on this item? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to move on to item number 5. I want to thank Deputy Secretary James for being here. Last time we held the vote on this item and asked him to come back before us and provide us with an update on the Department's efforts to stand up and in-state facilities to be able to handle all of our Maryland kids with developmental and behavioral challenges. Thank you, Secretary James.
Thank you, Governor, Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. Before I start, Governor, please accept my deepest condolences and those of our department. Item 5S is our contract with Wood Services Incorporated in Pennsylvania for residential child care services. It is a one-year contract with a one-year option with an overall value of $4.1 million, approximately $4.1 million, and would cover the placement of 11 children at that program. In the larger question, and specifically with regard to Judge Rodenberg Center and the children there, when I was before this body in late March, I offered a time frame of 60 days to have those youth transition back to Maryland. We are still working aggressively, but at this point, I do not believe that we are going to make 60 days. It is proving far more challenging to create a program and stand up a program from scratch, basically, in Maryland than we and our partners, the providers in the community and our other partners at state agencies had anticipated and hoped. We are in daily communication with the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, as well as the Department of Education and our other sister agencies, Governor's Office of Children, the Department of Disabilities, examining every opportunity to accelerate our timeline. At this point, our strongest candidate is a new program that is being created by a organization called Community Options. They're an existing provider for DDA. They have facilities in Maryland, but their time frame for creating the type of program that we would need to serve these youth is approximately July 1st, and that's what we're working towards. We are also continuing to work with other providers. We recently had a provider contact us and state that they believe that they have additional capacity and would be interested in expanding that. If that option becomes available and is the appropriate fit for those youth, we will move quickly on that and transition those youth to that program. But it has to be the right fit. We don't want to take children from someplace where they are stable and put them someplace that's a bad fit. So while our primary focus is on the youth at JRC, the state currently has 38 youth out of state, and we are focused on developing programs that serve all 38, with our goal being that we have substantial additional capacity by the end of this year. The state has formed an interagency work group on this, chaired by the Governor's Office for Children. We are meeting weekly. We have an aggressive timeline to identify what are our barriers currently and how are we going to move forward with this. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you.
Have you found common thread? You just sort of answered it, I think, is that you're working through it. But thus far, common threads in terms of the problems or the impediments to creating programs?
So I don't think that there's any single obstacle or impediment. I think it is simply that this is a very complex challenge, and that between the licensing requirements and the requirements to obtain a physical facility and then hire and train your staff and stand that up and get that all in place and lined up and assuring that the providers have the capacity to actually serve these kids. That's proving to be fairly challenging, and it's taking longer than we had hoped or anticipated. But that, I think, is...
I'm interested, and it may be down the road, in terms of lessons learned, whether there is the capacity in the state, either in the public sector or private, to have something like, for instance, an ongoing training capacity, mm-hmm. since there's a lot of turnover also.
Certainly. Well,
that sort of or ongoing site location capacity, mm-hmm. something like that that would facilitate them.
So, and Madam Treasurer, the training frequently is provided by the provider themselves. And so it is as much about hiring the folks and getting them and having enough of a class. But I certainly take your point. And one of the things that the interagency work group is focused on is not just how do we create a new program. It is, I think our experiences over the last year have really driven home that our system is not working the way we want it to work, that the interagency collaboration hasn't been what we wanted it to be, and that our system of licensing and monitoring really was not performing where we wanted it to be. So we're looking at overhauling that entire process as part of this interagency work group, and we look forward to reporting back to you on our progress with that.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I'm kind of confused because this issue is obviously one of great interest to the folks who are involved in this operation, not just the families, but everybody who's looking in on it. And your testimony today is that 37 people that you have out of state, by the end of the year, your interagency group is going to have a determination what about those 37? Are they going to be back in the state of Maryland?
So I want to be very careful, and as I've stated before, I will not, I can't in good faith say to the board that all 38 youth are going to transition back to Maryland. Not every out-of-state program is a bad program, and not every out-of-state program is a bad fit for the youth.
Okay, how many of the 38 do you predict are going to be back in state? Take a guess. I won't hold you to it. But what's a reasonable
number? So our overall goal, I think, is to try and get that number down to single digits. But we have to look at the age of the youth. Will the youth naturally age out of a program out of state? I think our overall goal is to have the capacity in the state. The 38 youth that are out of state, some of those, clearly, we want to transition back to Maryland as quickly as we can, including the 11 youth that are at the Woods program. Not that I'm not disparaging the Woods Services program, but anytime we've got 11 youth at a single placement, that suggests to us that that's sufficient capacity. There's enough of a cohort of youth that we should be able to serve
them in state.
What's
the timeline on those 11?
So our goal right now is to work with the providers and by the end of this year to have additional capacity to serve those youth within the state of Maryland. We're also actively working to prevent additional out-of-state placements. So as we're bringing up new capacity, in many cases, rather than transitioning one youth back to Maryland and sending another youth out of state, we're working to make sure first that additional youth don't go out of state. And that's what we've been focused on over the past several.
Why does this item that you have before us include the ability for other youth to enter or exit the program? What's that all about?
I think that's a recognition of the realities that placement needs emerge quickly, and between now and when we develop that additional in-state capacity, there may be a need for an additional placement.
Okay, and the other agencies that have out-of-state placements, you mentioned, is that how many kids are involved in that? Am I wrong? It's just you guys at 37.
No, and Mr. Comptroller, it's actually 38 in Maryland currently, and So I apologize. Off the top of my head, I cannot give you the number for total number of out-of-state placements. Department of Juvenile Services has some out-of-state placements with various programs that are very specialized for the needs of their youth. And there are children who are placed out-of-state that are funded by the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene as well. And that information is...
I have a lot of questions. I'll just send them to you. But my sense of this right now is that nothing much is happening. And it's because the agencies have a certain viewpoint that these kids are out of state, and we can, as long as we can get them aged into whatever it is, what do you call that, where they age out of care, I don't get a sense that anybody is really pressing to bring these kids home. And, you know, I'm all for the interagency work group, et cetera, but I'd like to see something happen in the next couple of weeks to get these kids home. And you say we don't want to take them out of a stable environment and bring them back to a bad environment. I think that's a quote. How about if they're in a bad environment now? How about if they're in a horrific environment right now? And we want to bring them back to a good, stable environment. And, yeah, I appreciate all the committee meetings. How about just taking some money and going out and saying to these fabulous facilities we have already in the state, we'll pay you money to take care of these Maryland citizens in Maryland. Why wouldn't that work?
Respectfully, Comptroller,
First of all, let me just weigh in here, and I tend to disagree with the Comptroller. I think that they've been working around the clock as hard as they possibly can and have done a great job under very trying circumstances. And it's not just committee meetings. And maybe you could address, Mr. James, that these are like the most difficult of cases, right, that have particular behavioral challenges, and they need certain expertise of care that we cannot provide in Maryland, right? It's not just we're sending kids out of state because we don't care about them. It's they're being sent to the places that can provide their specialized needs, right?
Absolutely, Governor. And at this point, the youth who are out of state at these residential programs really do represent the most difficult placements within our system. We have roughly 4,000 youth in out-of-home placements. We're talking about 38 youth. And that's still too many out of state. But
could you just, without getting into real specifics about individual cases, give us an idea of the kinds of challenges that some of these 38 kids may have that we can't handle here?
Certainly. Many of them engage in self-injurious behavior. Many are high flight risks, such that when we transport them, we can't use conventional commercial transportation. We have to hire an ambulance to drive them from Maryland to their new out-of-state placement because they require that level of close supervision. Many of them require two-on-one or three-on-one supervision because when these children and these youth who are 18 and 19 years old in many cases weigh 250 pounds, are 6 feet tall. When they become agitated, it takes 3 to 5 staff members to de-escalate their behavior and maintain them safely and maintain those around them safely. These are children not only with developmental disabilities, but in many cases behavioral disabilities or mental health issues. And I assure you, Comptroller, if this was simply a matter of money, this would have been solved months ago. This is not a problem that we can simply throw money at and snap our fingers and a new program opens its door tomorrow.
You've got to be kidding me that you're saying that. The state of Maryland compared to the state of Pennsylvania as far as our health care services and our infrastructure and our what about Spring Grove? What's going on out there? What's the capacity out there? 80% empty?
why don't we get some money, put it on the table, bring these kids home, get them out of a horrific environment up there at Woods, where, you know, I don't need to go over these things. Kids, 17-year-old falling off a bridge and being hit by cars. Another Woods Service employee guilty of manslaughter for leaving a kid in a van for multiple hours at 140 degrees. I mean, really. And I would just importune you to go and take some money from your budget and go to Hopkins and these other places, whoever these fabulous folks are that we have in our state, and say, look, we need to take care of our own kids, and they are not in a stable environment. That's the problem with these groups. Woods, whatever it is, Woods Services in Pennsylvania. And we're putting people up there as recently as 2 months ago, right?
Yes,
sent one up to Woods. And, yeah, no, I respect, I'm not being critical of anyone here. I'm just saying I've sat in a lot of these work groups, and they go on forever, and nobody discusses the right things, and they end up doing nothing. So hopefully in the next couple of months you can get these kids to come back to Maryland. And I just can't put it any more baldly. You know, these kids are not in safe, stable environments based on the history of these organizations. And to have 11 of our kids at Woods, the one I just mentioned, bring them home and pay the money and set up the program. It's, yeah, are they challenging? Sure. But we need to take care of them, not Pennsylvania. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, I did have one question on the contract. The contract's been withdrawn and rewritten, right?
So, Comptroller, the contract for Woods was originally structured as a 3-year contract with 2 1-year options. When that came to my desk, I rejected it. I asked them to revise it to make it a 1-year contract with 1-year option, which...
But did you... Is that the same pricing, or did we... reduce the pricing by X amount and the services by 3X?
No, we did not.
Are we paying more for less service?
No, we are not. The pricing for these placements is based on the individual youth. There's a contract that specifies the services that each youth gets, and the pricing is based upon that.
Okay, so we had a 5-year term with a cost of $5.3 million. Modified request is a 2-year term for $4.2 million. So that's based on the individual kids?
Yes, and it's based also on the one additional youth that's been placed there.
I'm not comfortable waiting till the end of the year, but just the comptroller.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. James.
Thank you.
Any other questions on the remainder of the DDM agenda? I move we approve. Is there a second?
Second.
Yes.
3-0. Thank you. We're going to move on to the university system agenda.
Good morning, Governor. University System
of Maryland
extends its condolences.
Thanks.
For the record, Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 7 items on the agenda. Here to answer any questions.
I don't have any. Any questions?
Move approval.
I did. I was just going to point out, just because we have a significant Bowie State University, that I was at a ceremony last week. Just want to memorialize in the record the naming of the building after the late James Proctor, who also was instrumental in getting the support and funding for this building, and how impressed I was. I hadn't visited Bowie for about a year at the campus. You all are doing a really good job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there a motion on the university system?
Move approval.
Second.
3-0. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
We're going to move on to information technology.
Good morning, Mr. Governor. You
have been in my family's thoughts and prayers and have our condolences.
Thank you.
Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, I'm Michael Leahy, the Acting Secretary of the Department of Information Technology. Today we have 10 items on your agenda, and I do have agency representatives to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0. Got off easy today. Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Governor Hogan. I'd also like to offer my and MDOT team's condolences.
Yes, thank you.
Good morning, Comptroller Francho and Treasurer Kopp. For the record, my name is R. Earl Lewis, Jr., Deputy Secretary of Maryland Department of Transportation. The Maryland Department of Transportation presents 16 items for your consideration.
Thank you. We have a Mike Lesnowski representing H.D. Miles, who signed up to speak on item 11. Are you here?
They're sending people in. Yeah, I think the DOT people are just coming in now. Because
all right, we're not going to give them much time.
All right.
Any other questions on any other items while we're waiting?
Thank you. I'm here for Mr. Lesnowski. My name is Brett Leininger, testifying on behalf of H.D. Miles, Governor, Comptroller, and Treasurer. Governor, my condolences. So H.D. Miles, just to give you a little bit of background, we had some questions. We provided some written testimony. Since submitting the testimony, we learned some additional information. We appreciate this opportunity to speak. We're supportive of the notion of providing services for the disabled. Mr. Lesnowski was a Maryland State Trooper who was suffered a head-on collision when he was on duty and turned this into an opportunity when he couldn't perform those duties into this company. Served as A ratings, received A ratings with the State Highway Administration. Questions we have regarding this contract is one dealing with fair market value. The proposed contract is looks like a 15% increase from what the incumbent's contract is. In my written testimony, I provided a table that shows in 13 other instances where we have contracts of this sort, there has been the trend has been a reduction upon the renewal of the agreement, and that has on average been a 29% reduction. Here we have a situation where NCIA is not subject to the living wage requirement, yet we have an increase of 15%. Just to give you some perspective here, we're talking about 74 acres of property, the northbound, the southbound rest stop areas with a slew of services that are provided. We have HVAC units, the servicing of 8 units, preventive maintenance, fixing them when they're broken, street lights up to 30 feet in height, roadway signs that could be up to 40 by 40, electrical systems, dealing with underground wires, plumbing and sewer lines, water main dig-ups, that kind of thing. We are told, we just learned subsequent to submitting our written testimony, that the NCIA is subcontracting out landscaping and snow removal, and that it's only 1% of the contract. We have trouble believing 1% is possible. I think that our experience in doing these types of contracts, as we do provide services in others, is more in the 30 to 40% range. We just can't fathom that would be the case. And with this type of preferred provider, the thought is that they are to specifically benefit the individuals that are disabled, and there should be no subcontracting allowed. It shouldn't be allowed to be a pass-through. The Lieutenant Governor's Task Force on Procurement Modernization has provided that there should be that should not be allowed when it's dealing with product purchases. We suggest that services as well. There's House Bill 1446, Senate Bill 1144 from this past session dealing with the same kind of issue. So with all due respect, we would suggest that we just need these questions answered. None of this is subject to an open bid process. We do subcontract out, but it's a competitive bid process. And we've heard we question as to also what's the criteria for determining whether a person is disabled to meet one of these contracts. I can tell you anecdotally, my client was on a site survey, when BISM and Maryland Works came out to determine whether or not they could provide this type of service at a different rest stop. And one of the community service providers said specifically to my client, we can find something wrong with just about anyone, which really just raises an eyebrow. I'm not saying NCIA said this, but this was a community service provider. And also when NCIA was notified that they would be the awardee on this contract, they solicited my client's employees to come work for them. So we think there are enough questions here. You have an increase, so you have an increase in the contract, so question to fair market value, and dealing with the criteria as well. So also we don't know of any bonding requirements. We don't know if there's any negotiations done. We did a PIA request and received limited information. So with that, I greatly appreciate the opportunity to testify before you.
Thank you. Any questions before we have SHA respond? Is there someone here that can give the agency?
Yeah, I have a few comments, and then I don't know if Bob Hoffman is here from Maryland Works. Yeah, okay. But first of all, we follow law. Obviously, Maryland State Finance Procurement Law requires us, says we shall get certain services and supplies from diverse providers, to include the Maryland Correctional Enterprises, Blind Industries of Maryland, and the Employment Work Program, which is what's in question with this procurement. The pricing selection committee determined that it was a fair price and a reasonable price, and we believe we followed all the requirements of the law in awarding this contract to Maryland Works. We can't go by hearsay. We go by the analysis of what was submitted and what the law requires. I'd also like to ask Mr. Bob Hoffman to come talk to Maryland Works.
Governor, my deepest condolences to you and your family. Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Bob Hoffman with Maryland Works, and we serve as the coordinating entity for the Employment Works Program, creating employment and business ownership opportunities for people with disabilities. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Any questions? Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Could somebody respond to what?
We actually responded to I think there were 14 or 15 questions that were submitted that we answered Macy Miles. And I can't go by hearsay. I mean, you go out and talk to somebody. All I can say is we follow the process. We know the value of providing jobs to folks who have disabilities, including disabled veterans. The company, NCIA, that is part of the Maryland Works system, is a company that employs those type of folks. And that the actual price is actually $2,230 less per year than what Mr. Lusley has claimed in the most recent documentation that we received.
And has the price decreased the way it apparently has for comparable jobs?
What's that?
Has the price decreased as it has apparently, unless you respond and say that's not so?
It's an under 10% increase in this case, and there are a number of factors contributing to that. One of the most significant is the escalation in the minimum wage. Between July 16 and July 18, there'll be over 20% in increases in wage cost. That amounts to a couple hundred thousand dollars at least on this particular contract. We also encourage the vendors to hire as many full-time employees as possible, and when full-time employees are hired, then the Affordable Care Act kicks in, and that accounts for some additional added cost. As far as the number of jobs, 75% of the jobs under this contract will be held out for people with disabilities. So of 12 full-time positions, 9 of them will be filled by persons with disabilities. And of the about 20 part-time positions, 75% of those will be filled by people with disabilities. NCIA already serves those folks. They're not going out recruiting or getting off of the required process to document that people have disabilities. Folks are generally referred to NCIA through the Division of Rehabilitation Services, the Developmental Disabilities Administration, the Behavioral Health Administration, et cetera. So these are folks that need services and supports, and they're referred to NCIA for those supports.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank
Any
you.
Other questions on the rest of the MDOT agenda? Is there a motion?
Move approval.
Second. Now we're going to close it out with DGS.
Governor, thank you.
That and cleanup.
Yes. And we're still in the morning, so.
So you got 3 minutes.
We have 3 minutes. On behalf of the men and women of General Services, we send our condolences to you and your family and the loss of your father. Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, again, good morning. For the record, I'm Ellington Churchill, Secretary for General Services. Department has 31 items on our agenda today. We are withdrawing item 5, and we're glad to answer any questions that you have at this time.
Questions? Motion?
Move approval.
Second. Thank you all very much. That concludes our Board of Public Works meeting for today.